December 20, 1321, Nova against the Secretary of Veterans Affairs, Mr. Stafford.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. For the past 5 years, VA has blatantly defied this Court's decision in Hudgens versus McDonald and continued to enforce its unlawful and erroneous interpretation of Diagnostic Code 5055 against countless veterans. Hudgens is controlling precedent and its reasoning remains sound. This Court should reject VA's refusal to follow the law.
Let me ask you about that. So let's get started.
Sure.
In your view, could the VA have done anything? I mean, Hudgens was backward looking. It was looking, and when they said post hoc rationalization, that means it's very backward looking. They were saying this is a rationalization that's for cases that have already been filed and are pending. We are now talking about a group of cases that all are going forward. After the regulation, after this manual provision and so forth was issued. Doesn't that make a difference?
No, Your Honor. The guidance was issued before the Court's decision in Hudgens. So I think that the guidance is the main focus of today's argument. So I don't think the fact that the guidance, you know, I just don't think the chronology works in that instance.
Well, tell me why. I mean, post hoc rationalization was... I think even Kaiser talks about post hoc rationalization as being something you can ignore. And that's because it's advanced to defend past agency actions against attack. That was true in Hudgens, and that's what the Court said. But they didn't get rid of the regulation or the manual provision. And so going forward, if it therefore is not to advance a defense of past agency action, we're now talking about using it to defend subsequent agency action. To me, that's a real distinction that hasn't happened, right?
I agree it's a distinction, Your Honor. I think the other problem with it is that it still conflicts with past agency interpretations. And so I think
that's the other leg of Hudgens. Okay.
Correct.
So the second leg of Hudgens is the board opinions.
Right.
Right? But we've got, like, 7 more years of board opinions. I mean, what the Hudgens panel was looking at were board opinions up until, I think, 2012. And they were overwhelming. So now if we're here in 2021 and we're looking at the body of board opinions, wouldn't you assume, I don't know what the numbers are, but I assume if it's a valid thing to look at those, wouldn't the overwhelming or the large majority of board opinions now go the other way? And so we would reach the opposite result if that is a factor we should be relying on?
I don't think so, Your Honor. Again, the guidance was issued before the Court's decision in Hudgens. So we're looking at when VA issued the guidance to determine whether today it would be entitled to our deference. And I still think the conflict...
We're frozen in 2015?
Your Honor, I don't think VA is frozen. I think VA has a perfectly viable avenue, and that's to go through notice and comment rulemaking and revise the regulation itself to clarify it's what it intends for it to mean today. I think that's what VA has tried to do with this interpretive rule, and that's why you don't see board decisions coming out today. Awarding benefits under 5055 for partial replacements, because today the board assumes that the regulation itself has been revised. And the board believes that it's bound.
That's the way it works. I mean, let's assume there was never a Hudgens case. So the board issues these revised things in 2015, and moving forward, the board follows them, as I think one would expect they would. Why isn't that okay?
But Your Honor, I think Hudgens is controlling on this point, that it says, you know, the prior conflict controls whether VA gets our deference on its interpretation of this regulation. But even setting Hudgens aside, I don't think the fact that, the Secretary may have issued some instruction to align, you know, internally within the agency, the interpretation, I still think, I don't think the agency is able to seek our deference in court. And that's, you know, clear from the Supreme Court's decision in Kaiser and Christopher and in the, you know,
I take the point on Hudgens. I think the first point and the major point, and I think maybe Hudgens could have stopped there, is saying we don't have, there's nothing to defer to because this is purely post hoc rationalization issued. We're not going to use it to defend past actions when it was issued after that for purposes only of litigation. That seems to be universally accepted doctrine. But that's no longer true in terms of the application of that regulation in our context. It's no longer post hoc rationalization because it's being applied to cases going forward, not to defend actions done previously. We're all living with Hudgens in terms of that bucket of cases that were decided. So you understand why I think the main premise of Hudgens has been undermined or is different than in this case?
I think the only reason it would be undermined or would be different is because VA refused to implement the Hudgens decision and follow what the court held, which is that 5055 is best read to cover both partial and total knee replacements.
In the absence of anything else, because it said we're not going to consider this new issuance of in 2015 because it's post hoc rationalization. If that had not been post hoc rationalization, if that's something the agency had issued 5 years before Hutchins had filed his claim, don't you think the result may well have been different?
No, I don't, because the interpretation would still conflict with all of the board decisions that had interpreted it the other way, and so therefore the VA would not be entitled to any hour deference.
So you think just the board decisions going a predominant number. Do we know what the percentage was?
At the time of Hutchins, I believe it was 11 favoring partial and total versus 3. Going the other way.
All right. And that was as of 2012.
I think there were some up until the court, I mean, the court's decision was in 2016, and I think there were board decisions up until, 2014, 2015.
Can I ask you about the third leg, which you cover in your brief of Hudgens, which is the veterans canon?
Sure.
What do we, let's assume hypothetically we reject your, we say Hudgens doesn't apply in terms of post hoc rationalization. We say that Hudgens no longer applies because we've got board decisions that go the other way, or for other reasons. You know, Kaiser has an interest, as you'll know, at the end of Kaiser in the Supreme Court's opinion, they start talking about the Solicitor General, and they don't reach the issue. They don't decide the issue. But they do give a very fulsome explanation of why the Solicitor General argued to the Supreme Court that board decisions aren't the kind of authoritative agency speech that should be given deference to, that should be relied on. Are you familiar with that? Do you think we should, that undermines in any way, shape, or form the notion that the percentage of board decision should be a compelling factor?
I don't, Your Honor, and the reason is because, the question here isn't whether the board decisions were going to themselves receive our deference. The question is whether the agency has issued conflicting interpretations. And if it has issued conflicting interpretations, and I think Kaiser makes this point clear, the agency is no longer entitled to the deference that it would normally be entitled to in interpreting its own regulations. In that,
Moving on to the veterans canon.
Yes.
If that's all we're left with, hypothetically, what do we do with this case?
I think Hudgens is also controlling on the veterans canon. Because Hudgens held that the regulation does not unambiguously favor VA, and that VA is not entitled to any hour deference given its conflicting interpretations. I think the pro-veteran canon would kick in that context and would require the regulation to be resolved in favor of veterans.
Well, what if we reject? Let's assume hypothetically we don't think. We think we've lost at this point with respect to this new adjudication of cases post-Hudgens. You've lost that conflicting interpretation argument. So let's assume we're not left with conflicting interpretation. We're not left with the post hoc rationalization. What do we do about the canon?
Sure, and I'm happy to answer that. I just want to clarify that. I still think the conflicting interpretation, because we're looking at what the validity of the guidance in 2015. We're not looking at an individual veteran's case filed today. So I think the state of affairs is, the relevant state of affairs is the state of affairs that existed in 2015 when VA passed, issued the guidance. But, going to the pro-veteran...
But don't you think, really? Because, Hudgens didn't say this guidance, didn't talk to the guidance. They said, and I think correctly, and certainly we're bound by it, whether we think it's correct or not, that it was issued in 2015 while this litigation was going on, long after Mr. Hudgens had filed his case. His case was pending. It was issued and now used in this case to defend what had been done prior to the issuance of that guidance. That's a completely different situation than the import of the guidance now, which is now being applied to cases going forward after the guidance issued. Doesn't that make a difference?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because the regulation is exactly the same. The regulation still, you know, still uses the same language that was at issue in Hudgens. You know, the guidance was also in the CFR. We had put it in there a year before Hudgens came down. And I don't think Hudgens was really, you know, trying to cabin its opinion to only post hoc actions, or to only prior actions. I don't think, you know, the post hoc rationalization was not the sole basis upon which the court declined deference.
The only other basis was because board decisions which preceded the guidance were overwhelmingly going one way. That's the only other thing, right?
Right, and I still think those interpretations, you know, still create the conflict today. I don't think that, you know, there's any reason for VA to sort of, you know, be able to insulate itself from the question of whether there are conflicting interpretations by just continuing to apply an erroneous interpretation after this court's already said that, you know, it shouldn't apply it.
Final question on our deference.
Sure.
Just a complete hypothetical.
Okay.
If we're left with this case, and let's assume there's no Hudgens and there's no prior litigation on this, we're left with this interpretive rule. What role does the Veterans Canon play in terms of our deciding whether or not we would defer to an agency's guidance in interpreting an let's assume the regulation is ambiguous. Agency provides guidance going forward, and we've got the Veterans Canon, which, you know, we know what it requires. What do we do with that?
Sure, and I know, you know, this court's issued several opinions recently grappling with this issue. I'll begin with the necessary caveat that we think Hudgens already addressed this in the footnote. Because there's no Howard deference, but assuming away all of that, it's our position that the pro-veteran canon would apply at the step one inquiry of the, you know, Auer and Kaiser, because, you know, Kaiser held that you have to look at all traditional tools of interpretation, and, you know, the pro-veteran canon has been applied by the Supreme Court and this court as one of those traditional tools.
Why do you think Kaiser never mentions the veterans canon? It's just because the parties never raised it at all. It's kind of odd, right, looking back on it, they referred to traditional tools of statutory construction in four or five places. And I think in every place that the Supreme Court refers to those, they don't define it, but they talk about text, history, and
purpose.
Thank you. No mention of the canon whatsoever. Is that just because it wasn't presented?
I think the court was focused on whether to overrule Auer or not, and I think, you know, the pro-veteran canon was one of the questions presented at the petition stage, I believe, at Kaiser, and the court did not grant on that issue. It just granted on the question of whether to overrule Auer. So I don't think the court, you know, was intending to catalog all of the traditional tools of interpretation in its opinion. I think it was simply, you know, admonishing courts not to jump to ambiguity quickly, but to instead employ all of the tools, that might be available.
So you think in this case, if all we had was the canon and no previous Hudgens thing, the veteran should win because
I don't think VA has any compelling textual arguments other than, you know, its dictionary definition of a knee joint. And I think the pro-veteran canon is one of the tools that, this court and the Supreme Court has applied at, you know, in ascertaining what the
text. So when would Auer ever apply?
I think
competing with the veterans canon.
Your Honor, I think the pro-veteran canon is just one canon of construction, so I think it would, you know, balance out with other textual indicators or other contextual indicators.
Well, I'm talking about a circumstance where we all agree it's ambiguous. We're left with ambiguity when we go through all these traditional canons of statutory construction. Oh, and then we've got the veterans canon, and we've got Auer and an agency interpretation. Again, no problems with Hudgens or whatever. What do we do?
Right. Well, I think, you know, the assumption in your question is that we've reached the conclusion that it's ambiguous. And I guess my submission is that before you get to that conclusion, you have to consider the pro-veteran canon. Because if there are no textual indicators on the other side, and the only, you know, all you have is sort of this bare text plus the pro-veteran canon, I think that resolves the ambiguity question before you get to deference.
Have we ever held that the pro-veteran canon alone would lead to a ruling in favor of the litigant, just looking at that canon alone?
I don't think that, Your Honor, I don't think this court's ever really, you know, held that specifically. But again, you know, I know that the court has grappled with sort of how to apply it in the Auer context. You know, here, of course, we still think Hudgens is completely controlling on this question because, VA has not demonstrated that it's entitled to any Auer deference in this case. And Hudgens, you know, specifically held in that final footnote that without Auer deference, you know, any ambiguity must be resolved in the veteran's favor.
Do the number of board decisions, I understand it's maybe more than 100,000 decisions each year, does that affect what you think about authoritative agency interpretations? Do you think that number has an impact on that?
I don't think the number really has an impact. You know, I'm not prepared to say, a specific number is necessary. I think Hudgens, already held that the 11 versus 3 is a pretty clear conflict, and we think that that's sufficient, for the court to resolve this case. I think VA can't really come to this court and say that, we don't really have control over all of our, board decisions, and therefore, you shouldn't consider the fact that several veterans are being compensated under this provision, whereas others aren't. We just don't think that that's a viable mechanism for achieving our deference.
Can I just?
Yeah, go for it.
Just going back to the board decisions, as I said, there's a language in Kaiser. Kaiser doesn't decide it. It just calls out the Solicitor General's view about you've got 1,000 board, I don't know how many, 10,000, thousands of board people issuing 80,000 decisions a year, none of which have any precedential value. And for all we know, they could all be different. And that's why the Solicitor General was said, this is not the kind of specialized agency authority that we're talking about deferring to. And there's a lot of, and Kaiser says, we're not going to go there. But there's a lot of language in Kaiser that gives us guidance in terms of what is something that we would defer to from the agency. And it does really not suggest anything like non-precedential board decisions, thousands of which are issued every year. Now, the panel on Hudgens didn't have the benefit of that language in Kaiser. But Kaiser, do you understand the language I'm talking about?
I do.
The whole point of looking at the agency's position is because it's uniform and it's consistent. And that's exactly the opposite of what we look for in board opinions generally, where they're non-precedential and they're all different. There's no uniformity. There's no speaking with one voice. So doesn't language in Kaiser suggest that we ought to be very careful about deferring to the board stuff?
Your Honor, I completely agree that you should not defer to board decisions. And, we took this position at the en banc stage in this case as well. But the question here is not whether the board decisions get our deference. It's whether the board decisions represent a prior agency interpretation of a regulation. And Hudgens makes clear that it does. That board decisions, because they render the final decision of the agency, they do interpret the regulation each time they apply it. And so the fact that you have several board decisions interpreting this regulation exactly the same way, and only a handful, supporting VA's position, it does show.
But the agency could change its position. I mean, even accepting what you say is correct, agencies can change their minds. In this case, I think the VA would say medical science is developing. What was a knee replacement, partial or full, 30 years ago is a substantially different procedure today. So even if that's correct, the agency is free to change its position, right?
I don't think it's free to change its position and then insist on our deference in court. I think, the Supreme Court's cases make clear that when you have prior conflicting agency interpretations of a regulation, you need to go through notice and comment if you want to clarify the regulation. And so, the medical sciences issue, that VA raises in its brief, I think is a perfect example of that. That is precisely the type of issue that, my clients would have loved to submit comments on to explain to the agency why medical science, doesn't require this sort of distinction that they're trying to draw here. But what VA cannot do is, try to modify the regulation itself, through an interpretive rule, which is what it's done here.
Yeah, would you just take a sentence or two to summarize directly the relief that you're asking for from this court?
Sure, Your Honor. We're asking this court to set aside the knee replacement guidance, the 2015 guidance, to set aside the knee replacement manual provision, and to accept VA's concession that the knee joint stability manual provision is invalid, and was invalid because it was not published in the Federal Register, and to dismiss our challenge to that provision as moot.
Okay, any more questions at the moment? All right, we'll save you rebuttal time.
Thank
Let's
you.
Hear from the government. Ms. Finnis.
May it please the Court, there are three issues before you today. With respect to the first issue, the Secretary asked that this Court deny NOVA's petition challenging the 2015 interpretive rule. That 2015 interpretive rule was a procedurally and substantively valid exercise of the agency's interpretive rulemaking authority.
Let me ask you about that if I could. And I think in Gray, the other side makes this point. You seem to be wanting to have it a couple ways with respect to the guidance, to the extent that you say you've got a note in the regulation. Does that make it any different? How does that matter? It seems like the government is telling us, it's an interpretive rule, but look, we put this note in the regulation, so maybe it ought to mean a little more. The other side calls you out for that in Gray, and I understand their point. So what's your position?
Understood, Your Honor. And so I'll direct the panel back to this court's NOVA decision from 2001, in which something similar occurred. The agency exercised its interpretive rulemaking authority by publishing in the Federal Register its interpretation of the death and compensation benefits provision in that case, but it also, by way of that Federal Register publication, made changes to the regulation itself, right? It revised language in the regulation itself. And the court in NOVA 2001 found that that action was not arbitrary and capricious and sustained it. So there's nothing inherently or procedurally problematic in our 2015 interpretive rule, revising the regulation itself by the addition of that note.
Well, you can't revise it, can you? You can maybe clarify it. I mean, if you were going to revise it, substantively revise it, you'd have to do notice and comment rulemaking, right?
Yes, to the extent, to my word choices. I'm not meaning revise as a substantive term. I mean revise it in the sense that they added a note. They've clarified their interpretation.
Okay, but you can't do a revision.
Not in the way that you're using the word revision as a substantive change. No, you cannot. But turning back to your question, it is relevant in the context of this panel's review that the 2015 interpretive rule inserted a note into the regulation, because this court is now charged with determining whether or not the regulation in effect with this clarified note is arbitrary and capricious. We submit that it's, and how the court would reach that determination, right? We submit that that's what makes the regulation before this panel different than the regulation that was in front of the Hudgens 2 panel. Hudgens 2 definitively held that the prior unclarified version of the regulation was ambiguous. This court and VA is bound by that aspect of the Hudgens 2 decision. The prior unclarified pre-2015 version of the regulation was ambiguous. As the court held in Hudgens 2 at page 637, the regulation then in effect, which was applicable in Mr. Hudgens' claim, neither explicitly included nor excluded partial knee replacements.
Do you also read Hudgens as saying, and there's nothing to defer to because all of this 2015 stuff is simply, we're going to look at it as if it's a post hoc rationalization to what came before it. And so we're not saying whether it's good enough or it's not good enough. It's just irrelevant. We don't defer to things like post hoc rationalization.
Correct, Your Honor.
And so why should you get us to defer to it now? I mean, you know, your friend and I had this conversation. What's the difference between the 2015 regulation? Same words. What Hudgens did with it in 2016 and what you're asking us to do with it going forward.
Understood. So to look at whether or not Hudgens 2 is controlling or persuasive here, you have to look at the context in which that holding was entered. Hudgens 2 was a veterans benefits appeal. It was not a rulemaking challenge. Mr. Hudgens had several years earlier filed a claim for benefits for his partial knee replacement and was denied those benefits under DC 5055. He's entitled to benefits under other parts of the diagnostic code, but not in VA's view, under DC 5055. That appeal wound its way up to the Federal Circuit, and at that stage, the court was charged with interpreting the version of the regulation that was in effect on Mr. Hudgens' claim, right, which was filed years earlier. It was a version of the regulation in effect prior to 2015. It held that version of the regulation, without the subsequent clarifying note, was ambiguous. It neither explicitly included or explicitly excluded partial knee replacements. So how would the court resolve the ambiguity? Well, the government at that point had submitted the 2015 interpretive rule that had just been promulgated while that appeal was pending. And Your Honor's correct. The court held this is a post hoc rationalization. We're not going to defer to it. In the absence of an agency interpretation, how will we resolve this ambiguity? Well, we will resort to the pro-veterans canon and find in favor of Mr. Hudgens' appeal. And so the version of the regulation pre-2015 in effect and governing Mr. Hudgens' claim, Hudgens 2 held, encompassed partial knee replacements.
Okay, but you've got to get to answering my question, which is we're dealing with the same paper in Hudgens and here in terms of the 2015 submission. So is it your position that Hudgens' right, we follow Hudgens because in that context, in the context in which it was presented, it was post hoc rationalization, which the court should not have considered. And how do we get to, but in this context, we can treat it differently.
Understood.
Your friend suggested that, no, you can't treat the same piece of paper differently in two different contexts. And I assume your position is the opposite. So tell us why.
Yes, because in this context, the 2015 interpretive rule is not post hoc, right? It's being applied by the VA to resolve claims for partial knee replacement in effect upon the effective date of that 2015 interpretation through February 7th, 2021, when the entire scheme has been revised through notice and comment rulemaking, right? So there's a window there where the 2015 interpretive rule was in effect, and it's to those claims that VA wants to apply or intends to apply the 2015 interpretive rule. It's not post hoc in that context.
Could I ask you, I don't know if this stuff is in the record. I'm just curious. What this case involves then is a 5-year window or a 6-year window of cases, because claims before that are covered by Hudgens, and claims after that will be covered under this new regulation. Has the new regulation been challenged?
Not to my knowledge.
Okay. All right. So do you have any estimate about the number of claims we're talking about that fall within that 5-year window? And if you have any further information about whether or not it involves the partial knee issue?
The information is not in the record, and I don't have it. But I would also submit it's not relevant, right? Because this court is charged with deciding whether or not the 2015 interpretive rule is arbitrary and capricious. We submit that it's not because it clarifies what this court has previously held was an ambiguous regulation, and it clarified it with an interpretation that Hudgens 2 recognized was a permissible interpretation of that ambiguity. Hudgens 2 didn't adopt it for that claim, right? But it did recognize that it was.
Yeah, I didn't suggest the numbers were relevant. I was just curious about what universe we're talking about.
Understood.
Can you also speak to the board stuff, because maybe I misread your brief. I understood in your brief you put a pretty thick thumb on the scale saying, even no matter what you do in this case, you ought to be really careful what you say about these board opinions. And obviously we've got Kaiser reiterating what the Solicitor General said. Now, we can't undo Hudgens and its controlling precedent. And it did put emphasis on the number of board decisions. What are we to do with that in this context, in this case?
My answer is severalfold. So not only do we have Kaiser, which postdates Hudgens 2, we also have this court's en banc decision in this appeal, right? The Nova en banc decision in this appeal at page 1382 discussed the volume of board decisions and the non-precedential nature of those decisions, and stated that by themselves, it does not reflect the agency's authoritative or official position. Not binding in future cases and appear not to be entitled to our deference. That's it. Pages 1382 and 1384, footnote 14. Just for clarity of record.
So wait, do you consider that sort of overruling or restating what the panel in Hudgens said about deferring to board opinion, to what board opinion said?
I think it erodes the foundation of that finding in Hudgens 2, right? Subsequent events. Subsequent decisions of the Supreme Court and this court sitting en banc have eroded that foundation. So for that reason, it's not controlling or no longer controlling or persuasive. I also want to point out for the court, NOVA makes several representations that the board decisions are actions of the agency. The board is an independent authority who issues individual claims by the thousands, decisions by the thousands. And their mandate is certainly to apply VA's statutory and regulatory scheme. But they are an independent authority. They are not a part of the VA.
Are you arguing in favor of our deference here?
We don't have to get to our deference because the regulation as revised by the 2015 interpretive rule is no longer ambiguous.
What about the pro-veteran canon? So if we find that that canon of construction applies, what do you have to show to win?
If the pro-veterans canon applies, it would only apply if the regulation remains ambiguous, which we submit it's not. I mean, then you would be getting into a discussion of our. I think the Supreme Court and this court's authority does not, other than in dissents, suggest that the pro-veterans canon is used, above and beyond or before our deference. But it is our position in this appeal that we don't get there. The court doesn't need to reach out.
I don't think I understand your answer to Judge Cunningham's question. It's ambiguous. The regulation is ambiguous. And I thought you were saying your interpretive guidance plus the note, whatever we want to call that, because it's not been done through notice and comment rulemaking, deserves our deference because we're clarifying what the agency's authoritative view is of this ambiguous language, which is just need that doesn't differentiate between full and partial, right?
That is an argument that we made in our brief in the alternative, but our primary argument is that we don't get there. It's not ambiguous.
Well, let's assume it is ambiguous, and then Judge Cunningham's question about what we do. If we're left with an ambiguous regulation, you've got an agency interpretive rule that says it means one thing. What do we do with the canon? How does the canon play into that? If it's ambiguous, does the canon get applied first, and therefore there's no ambiguity remaining because the canon puts a thumb on the scale for the veteran, and so we never have to apply our deference at all? How does this work?
I'm not aware of any Supreme Court authority or majority opinion of this court that has held that the pro-veterans canon applies above and before other canons of statutory construction.
But if it's ambiguous such that one needs to consider whether or not to apply our deference, isn't that overridden by the veteran's preference? Doesn't that end the whole debate if it's ambiguous?
If the pro-veterans canon were to end every ambiguity, the court would be completely eviscerating all of the statutory and regulatory authority VA has to interpret statutes and provide for their interpretation in a procedurally and substantively valid way, right? But there would be no regulatory authority. There would be no interpretive rulemaking authority, substantive rulemaking authority, no ability to clarify something that's ambiguous. If the pro-veterans canon applied above everything else.
In other words, you're saying that if we apply it to resolve every ambiguity, whether it's statutory or regulatory, there is no such thing as Chevron or our deference in the VA space. Is that what you just said?
It's hard for me to opine on every hypothetical that, okay. that could...
That, that's the point. That would be an issue, or at least a question or a concern.
It would be a question or concern, right. And I think for this court's purposes, you just don't have to get there. The regulation is clarified by the 2015 interpretive rule, the Federal Register publication, as well as the note that that was inserted into that regulation by the 2015 interpretive rule.
How different would your argument be if you hadn't clarified the regulation with the note, if we were just left with the manual guidance, whatever it is we're talking about? How strongly do you, in order to prevail, how strongly do you have to rely on the note essentially becoming part of the regulation itself? Which I guess in your view means that you don't even need our deference.
Correct. But I think the court in that hypothetical would be denying Nova's petition challenging the interpretive rule either way, right? Because the note was not only inserted into the regulation, but also appears in the 2015 interpretive rule, in the Federal Register publication, as does the rationale for that 2015 interpretive rule. Right. So even if you didn't look at the note, you know, specifically in the Code of Federal Regulations, it's in the 2015 interpretive rule, which is in the Federal Register.
Getting back to just a follow on Judge Newman's question about the canon, and this is kind of hypothetical, but do you think there's a distinction? We have all sorts of cases, and sometimes we really have statutory language that is ambiguous, and we have to apply the tools of statutory construction. This is, you know, we've got a case called Buffington, a precedential opinion that came out in August that was kind of instructive, saying there's a gap. Congress didn't speak to this, so there's no veterans canon to apply. In this case, we've really not got Congress doing much of anything, other than delegating to the agency, fill this huge gap, which is to draft diagnostic codes, which is your specialization and certainly nothing that Congress is going to dive into. Does that color the way we should view this in terms of deference to the agency and reliance on the agency as opposed to other doctrinal things?
I think the traditional tools of statutory construction don't encompass the pro-veterans canon. I think it is a tool for resolution of veterans' appeals.
Well, it's a different kind of canon. It's not a it's a canon that we have to apply. It's not a linguistic canon. It's what some have called a substantive canon, some have called a normative canon, and different people have expressed different views about what role that plays, but it is a canon construction, right?
I would submit it's not on the same par as things like plain language, legislative history, and deference to agency.
And do you think, assuming we think we need to apply it, how we apply it, how does it matter? I mean, is it, if there are two equally plausible ways to interpret an ambiguous thing, then the veterans canon comes into play? Does it matter? I mean, is it different as opposed to one much better reading and one less better reading, but we still, because there's still ambiguity, the canon still picks the less good reason? Do you have any views on whether the canon is kind of a tiebreaker kind of thing, or the canon has more heft than that?
I mean, we're sort of in a land of hypotheticals here. I think it should not supersede VA's interpretation of its own regulation. It has been statutorily charged with promulgating regulations by interpretive rule and by substantive rule to implement the congressional mandate, right? Their congressional mandate, their statutory mandate, is to provide for benefits for veterans for impairments that are service-connected.
Are you suggesting there's an order for whether or not you apply our deference before the veterans canon or vice versa? Like, are you suggesting any ordering there?
That sort of briefing is not developed in this case based on the procedural posture, but in other cases, I believe we have.
Okay, and what would that ordering be then?
Our deference or deference to the agency's interpretation would supersede the pro-veterans canon.
Okay, any more questions for counsel? Anything else for counsel? Thank you. We'll hear from the other side. Mr. Stafford.
Thank you, Your Honor. Three quick points. The first point is that the regulation in this case is exactly the same regulation that was at issue in Hudgens. VA offered the exact same interpretation that it is offering of that identical regulation that it offered in Hudgens. So the reasoning in Hudgens is exactly the same in this context. The 2015 interpretive guidance that we're challenging here came before Hudgens. So VA was not purporting to change its interpretation or anything. And in fact, the guidance itself says this
But Hudgens, clearly, the question before Hudgens was whether they're going to apply the regulations that were hot off the press to a claim that had been filed and adjudicated before those regulations came into effect. And, you know, and your view is that that doesn't matter in terms of the temporal existence of these regulations, in terms of whether or not we should say call them, as the Hudgens court did, post hoc rationalizations?
So, Your Honor, I just want to be clear. The regulation itself is identical. The regulation 5055.
I'm sorry, I'm talking about the interpretive rule.
Sure, and the only reason VA would issue an interpretive rule is to try to seek our deference in court and to align its internal agency adjudicators on an interpretation. But the our deference inquiry doesn't change in this context because of the conflicting interpretations. And I would also point out, you know, they focus a lot on the arbitrary and capricious portion of this, and we do think Hudgens also eviscerated every basis in the guidance itself. You know, VA's whole position was that this was not a change in interpretation, but in fact a long-standing interpretation, ignoring all of the board decisions and Chief Judge Casel's dissent in the Veterans Court opinion in that case. So, you know, we don't even think the guidance could survive, you know, aside from that. The second point I want to make, though, is that, you know, VA has now admitted that it's not seeking our deference in this case, but is instead resting its entire case on the fact that the regulation itself was amended. And, you know, we don't think that that's, you know, that's viable under the APA at all. The APA requires notice and comment rulemaking to amend a regulation. And, you know, I think it's telling that the guidance itself uses the word amend because that is what VA thought it was doing. It thought it was amending the regulation. And that, you know, that's not permissible with an interpretive rule. And as we point out in our reply brief, if you accept this position that, you know, VA doesn't even need our deference anymore, excuse me, because the regulation is now unambiguous, I mean, you've eviscerated the entire our framework. Anytime an agency finds an ambiguous regulation, it could always just stick in an interpretive rule. And VA has not pointed to any case where this has worked. And, you know, they identify the NOVA 2001 case. But in that case, VA was revising its interpretation of a statute, not a regulation. And so, you know, therefore, it wasn't revising the source authority that it was purporting to interpret. It was, you know, revising its own interpretation and coming to this court seeking Chevron deference. Here, VA is revising the very thing that it is purporting to interpret. And that's, you know, the sort of question-begging reasoning that would eviscerate the our framework. So, you know, we still think Hudgens is perfectly controlling here. Nothing has changed, and the court should set aside the rules based on Hudgens alone. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks to counsel. The case is well presented. It is taken under submission.